Are farmers going to get their support? Are people who need help buying their groceries, are they going to still get their help? You know, there definitely could be an opportunity to weigh in.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, when we talk about farm to table, probably no big issue can affect it more than the farm bill, believe it or not. There's so many things that can happen in the United States farm bill that affects trade, it affects research, it affects programs for consumers, for people that are in need of help with their purchasing. It has subsidies in it. It has everything in it. It's a lot to get your arms around, but it's something that many of us are more than just a little curious about and also concerned and realize that it has an impact on farmers and consumers. One organization that's taking a close look at that and other issues is the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and I'm happy to have Sam Fromatz with me today. And Sam is the editor-in-chief of the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and it's an independent, nonprofit news organization producing investigative journalism about food, ag, and environmental issues. Sam, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Sam, I'm thinking when I look at the introduction I just gave of you and talked about an investigative journalism, I mean, you are looking at all things, what, food and environment, and you and your reporters are watching what's happening and what needs to be happening. How do you do that?
Roger, I think I'll talk about a little bit about how we work, because that'll help answer the question.
Sure.
And essentially, we were started when media was imploding around 2010, and we saw a lot of really talented reporters being cut from publications, and especially in our area of interest, which was food, agriculture, and environmental health. And so we, and by we, I mean a bunch of writers came together and asked the question of whether we could start a nonprofit that could help some of these really talented writers and reporters do their work and then place the material with publications that were cutting their budgets. We felt it would be a win-win in the sense that the reporters would get work and the publications would get support, both in the form of financial support, because we're helping pay for the writers to do their work, and then also our editorial expertise, because we really focus in on these areas.
You know, let me stop you just for a second, because
yeah.
You're saying it was 2010. We're used to, in the last year or two, talking about that. It's drawn attention of consumers because you end up having like every newspaper in America, many magazines have cut their staff and some of them have just closed their doors and some newspapers are ceasing to do, you know, newspaper per se and instead going straight to online. But everybody's cut way back. I guess the reason I'm saying that is it's a lot of us feel like it's a recent phenomenon. What was happening around 2010 that you were seeing these cutbacks?
It has been a long-term trend in newspapers of shrinking staffs and, you know, losing out to the internet, which may not have the same news approach as a newspaper. You know, you also had the recession, the deep recession of 2009, 2010, further implosion of advertising. So that, you know, led to the cutback in staff. And it was especially acute in our area, although you still have quite a good deal of reporting and TV shows, you know, on chefs and, you know, cupcake wars and that kind of thing. Stories about farming, about agricultural issues, about where your food comes from, although still present, you know, they're fewer and far between. And that was the gap that we hoped to fill. And I think the Farm Bill is a good example of that. It's kind of the biggest piece of legislation that affects the way our food system works that nobody knows about. the typical person on the street has probably never heard of the Farm Bill.
Yeah.
Even though it's a $500 billion piece of legislation that comes along every 5 years.
Yeah, I've been watching it for years, and I'm still confused every time it comes up. And people have opinions on the Farm Bill because, I mean, when you look at the Farm Bill, it is, it's what, for 5 years? There are some things affecting food, agriculture, and the environment that aren't in the Farm Bill, but not much. I mean, of programs, areas to get expenditures. For example, without a Farm Bill, I would imagine there continues to be a USDA, and they continue to get paychecks because they're funded from ongoing funding of the various offices.
Yeah.
And the same thing for the other departments that impact us. But the Farm Bill includes what's controversial, like subsidies, which gets a lot of talk, but also SNAP programs, which used to be food stamp programs. And research and market development and promotion. There's a wide, wide spectrum that gets thrown
right, and
into
conservation
this.
Programs so that farmers could get payments to set aside land for, you know, natural habitat or practice conservation measures that, you know, protect air and water.
So when you look at this whole package starting to take shape, how does it get into the hopper? I mean, does somebody like the secretary, or not necessarily the Department of Agriculture, but the chairman of the House Ag Committee and that committee, or the Senate Ag Committee, do they start out with what was previously in the Farm Bill and start marking it up of things they want to cut and things they want to add? Is that how it gets going?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the big thing to understand, I think, is that 80% of the Farm Bill, 80% of the spending goes for programs like SNAP and others like it that help people buy food who would otherwise not be able to afford it.
80%,
that's a really
Sam?
Important piece. 80%.
Wow.
Right. You know, and then the next big portion is for farm support programs, which is in the form of payments to farmers to help them manage the swings, the ups and downs of the farming economy. Biggest part of that now is crop insurance, where the government essentially subsidizes an insurance program for farmers so that if they produce less than they expected or prices fall below what they expected, the government, the insurance program will make up the difference. So that's a big component of the Farm Bill now as well.
It doesn't, just the insurance program a little bit, that's confusing to some people because they're used to hearing about subsidies. And now when you hear about insurance, that doesn't seem to be as, I don't know, it doesn't seem as bad a word as subsidies do to some people.
Right. Well, that was the big change in the last Farm Bill and the 2014 Farm Bill. There was a big change from subsidies, which were coming under a lot of criticism, because essentially the argument was it's not the free market, it's a government-supported market, and there was a switch from that to insurance. The government will pay the farmer, not in the case, I mean, in the case if there's an accident, you know, if there's a hailstorm that wipes out their crop, but also they get a payment if crop prices fall below a certain point, you know, that's set in the insurance policy. From a business perspective, I think the critics say it's kind of a sweet deal because, I mean, for example, in my business, if it does badly, I don't get, the government doesn't help me out.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but I think there's not, farming is producing food, so it's critical. And then secondly, that it's subject to, you know, these swings in markets and weather that other businesses might not have. You know?
Well, it doesn't really cover every single thing that can be grown, as I understand, or anything that comes
right.
on a farm.
The insurance covers the major commodity crops. I mean, what's known as the specialty crops, you know, the vegetables and fruits in California, I think there's some very small programs that help them out, but basically they're not. You know, the bulk of these programs goes to commodity farmers.
Which we think of as what? Corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, maybe rice.
Rice.
Those are have been the big commodities.
Exactly. So there's still, you know, that's still a flashpoint. There's still critics who say that, you know, even if we've switched from direct payments to crop insurance, it's still costing, like, bucket loads of money, especially in years when crop prices are down or when there's, you know, drought that takes out the cotton crop or whatever it is.
Well, is there any reason the farmer that's got one of those commodity crops, any reason that they wouldn't sign up for insurance? I mean, it seems like it is a pretty good, like a pretty important thing to do. Does it cost them?
It does cost them to buy the insurance, but the key point is that the government subsidizes part of the premium. So, like, when you get car insurance, you're paying the insurance company for the whole cost of the insurance. But in this case, the government is paying for a portion of that bill. So what the critics say is that gives an incentive to farmers to take more risks. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you know that a government-supported program is going to bail you out, well, you might plant on land that's more risky or, you know, that's more marginal because you're not as worried that you'll lose the farm, as it were, you know, because the government will make up for a loss. So that's been one big criticism of it. But, you know, in the past couple of years, I mean, the farm economy has been, commodity prices have been very low, and farmers, their income is down, and so these programs did provide support, I think, in a way that they were designed to do. But they do come under criticism in the same way that on the other side of the counter, you know, the SNAP and the food support programs for people in need, those have come under, those have really been the flashpoint in this farm bill, trying to cut back on those programs. And has really split Democrats and Republicans.
Before we go into the SNAP and those and the consumer side, I want to one more thing about the like these programs. There's different kinds of farms than there were, say, when the last farm bill that are small, local, organic, and even rooftop. You know, they're popping up in cities that are vertical growing, and you know all sorts of things that are going on that have changed. Are these new style and smaller farms, are they also able to participate in a program like these?
In a very limited way. I mean, I don't, to my knowledge, there isn't any insurance program for urban, you know, farmers doing indoor farms with LED lighting and that kind of thing.
So I would imagine, somebody that wants them to is paying a lobbyist or starting a campaign to try to, as this farm bill conversation is taking place, saying, hey, don't leave us out. I want to be treated as well as a wheat farmer in Kansas.
Right, exactly. I mean, that was an argument that went on for a long time in the organic sector, which is probably the biggest, you know, sort of alternative ag that's kind of grown into a real industry. And there were, there have been limited attempts to create insurance programs specifically for organic farmers because the typical insurance schedules don't really work for them because of differences in how they farm and their yields and everything else. So there were some programs that were crafted for them. But, I mean, for the most part, like your small farm who's growing vegetables for their local market and selling at the farmer's market. I mean, they're not getting any of the benefits of these types of programs.
Well, let's switch gears to the other 80%. You say that's not just on the farmer side in this whole farm bill, which there's always been a debate as whether or not those things should be separated, because some say, okay, well, should have a consumer bill and a farm bill or call it something else. But to tie these two together, kind of reminds me of when you go to a wedding and you walk in the back door and they ask you, are you guest of the bride or the groom? And you have to pick which side you sit on. I don't know why I keep conjuring up that image with a farm bill. It seems like a forced marriage in a way that you come in and you're coming from different perspectives. But Sam, that's by plan, isn't it? I mean, some people feel like The only way you can get enough support for the farming programs is to have it important to an urban population and vice versa. Right.
Well, that was the original impetus, was if you merged the farm programs with those of, you know, the food security programs, what was then food stamps, you would get urban lawmakers to sign on to the bill. You know, the urban Democrats would support the farm programs, and in return, the, you know, legislators from farm states would support the food security measures. So, you know, everybody kind of got what they wanted, you know, by helping the other guy. The thing is that, you know, there's a lot of things that are happening now. One, you know, obviously from the White House and in Congress, and even preceding the current administration in Congress, you know, there have been attempts to really whittle away at what's now the SNAP program, which is what food stamps became. So there's been that, and then and that has caused a lot of friction. But at the same time, the irony is that the majority of food stamps are now are dispensed to rural areas. You know, you have the case of a lot of Republicans from rural areas opposing programs that benefit their own constituents. So it's a huge, it could potentially sink the farm bill in this cycle, or at least cause, you know, major delays in it getting through.
Really, like people that might be field workers that don't make a very high salary, obviously, may in fact be using food stamps or where is the SNAP program currently.
Yeah, not only field workers, but people who live in rural areas. I mean, as farms have consolidated, the number of people working on farms has gone way down. Rural unemployment is higher. You just have a lot of, you have poor people in rural areas who really depend on these programs, you know, or places where jobs have disappeared. And it's not inner city urban areas, you know, or not just inner city urban areas. But for Democrats, this is like, you know, core to the social safety net. You know, we should, and this goes back to the Great Depression, you know, that we should come up with programs to feed the hungry.
So those kind of recommendations usually fall into a couple of categories. One is to require more work or to require demonstration that people are working to be able to get these benefits or doing something or trying to get, you know, to try to get employed. And I believe there's some of that kind of thing that's in the hopper, too. Others are to give more commodities away rather than just what would be stamps or the SNAP certificates or the cards that allow them to make certain purchases.
USDA called a harvest box.
Yeah. So opinions, right? So opinions on all of those things. So these two big broad areas, like how do you deal with helping farmers? How do you deal with helping the needy? That all is thrown into this big mixing bowl that is the farm bill.
Right, and there's been calls to like split the farm bill, to like take the nutrition and food security benefits out of the farm bill, so you just have two separate programs, but the farm state legislators who are, you know, part of this, or some of them oppose that because, you know, they could potentially lose, you know, a big block of support. I mean, you know, these Democrats, mostly urban lawmakers who are stalwart supporters of food security benefits, you know, the farm state legislators are worried that those, you know, that their partners across the aisle won't support farm programs anymore. So they're, you know, so that's another, that's one reason to keep the bill, you know, enmeshed in one piece.
So in these broad categories of subjects, you're going to again have members of the committees that are going to be filing kind of amendments or trying to put something in the bill. So in the hearings of the bill, there will be people from maybe large cities that have ideas of what they want to see on the farm program, and even on the farm side, some that are saying ideas they have on the consumer side. But the way that this goes into motion, is it that constituents have complained or talked about or made recommendations, lobbyists are making suggestions, and then actual members of the Senate or the House sponsor an idea and try to get the committee to vote for it, to stick it into this working draft of the Farm Bill. Is that kind of it?
Sort of. In the past, it's been a nominally bipartisan process where both sides, both Democrats and Republicans on committee on the House and the Senate Ag Committee, will craft a bill. The House Ag Committee put forward a bill that was crafted by Republicans in secret, so Democrats didn't get to look at it, and it called for major changes in these in the SNAP program for what's known as able-bodied working adults, so adults who potentially could get a job. And what the Republicans wanted to do was shift money into job training programs, so you would have to either have a job or you would have to be in a job training program in order to qualify for these SNAP benefits if you were an able-bodied working adult. Democrats made a number of objections, one being that the amount of money they were proposing for job training wasn't enough to go around to all the states. And then secondly, people weren't able to get jobs in many cases, because they're failing drug tests, because the opiate problem is so big and around the country. So, it wasn't simply a job training issue. And there's been analysis of how many, over a million people could lose SNAP benefits because of this. And then this past week, when the bill came up on the House committee, the vote was right in a party line vote. All the Republicans voted for it and the Democrats opposed it. So it's sort of the beginning of a pretty ugly conflictual process.
For some of the people listening to this podcast, it might be 6 months from now they listen to it, because the thing that I find interesting about these old podcasts is that they're kind of evergreen, and so people listening in to not necessarily hear the news, but to get more information about an issue, an idea,
right,
a development, a trend, and so some of them will have the advantage of listening to this after the fall elections of November 8, 2018, and they may or may not still have one party controlling both houses of Congress. Will the Farm Bill have to be voted on prior to an election date, or is the Farm Bill likely to go, right up to the end of 2018, or possibly even sometime into 2019, and again, the political winds may shift by then.
Right, and the big answer is nobody knows. but the starting line shot that came out of the House Ag Committee, every Democrat's going to oppose it. So in the House and the Senate, even, Senate Republicans have said it's a non-starter. So, but who knows where that takes us. If they can, both sides are willing to compromise in some sense, whether they think it's important enough or whether they'll punt it. And, the risk for the Republicans if they punt is that the Democrats will do well in the midterm, and then that'll change the whole, as you mentioned, change the complexion of the committees and thus the outcome of these debates. So,
I want to shift gears, but first, before I do, on these particular hot-button issues, I think we need to point out that if people have an interest in this, and whatever their points of view is, they should be communicating with their congressman and their senator, and they usually have offices back in the home districts that they can go to and express their interest or concerns. And I know some of these, it's hard to imagine people saying, okay, I'm going to wade into this because it's so confusing. But they should care, and they should express themselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, the big question is, you know, are farmers going to get their supports? You know, are people who need help buying their groceries, are they going to still get their help? You know, I mean, they're kind of big issues. And so I think they're, there definitely could be an opportunity to weigh in. So.
And laying in, Sam, there's other things in the Farm Bill that, say, for example, research funding for both agricultural production and also even consumer outreach programs. There's a lot of that that's covered in the Farm Bill as well, isn't there? Are they in jeopardy?
Everything's in jeopardy if the Farm Bill doesn't pass.
Sure.
The question is what happens, you know, and in which case if something doesn't pass, they'll probably just extend the previous one. But, yeah, research is a big issue. And I've seen reports that U.S. research spending is falling way behind, you know, other nations like China, I think, is the leader now in spending on ag research. Those are all kind of big issues.
You know, Sam, there are just so many things. There's so many issues that are percolating along that we could have a podcast about each one of them. I just want to mention briefly that you're also watching something that affects American fisheries. I think that there's something that you say is almost the same as the Farm Bill is to agriculture. The Magnuson-Stevens Act is to fisheries. You're watching genetic engineering, you're looking at food waste, you're looking at bees, we've mentioned a little bit, and consolidation just keeps rolling on, that we have fewer and fewer companies that are larger and larger companies, and that's disconcerting. I can't even imagine what a whiteboard looks like in your office that you start plotting and looking at all of these things that are boiling up that are affecting consumers and farmers and the environment. How are you making these choices of saying these are the things that are somewhat limited staff? I mean, you don't have hundreds of reporters. You've got, you know, a good small team. But how do you end up saying, okay, these are the priorities that we're going to be focusing on? We're going to invest our time in.
And all of our stories are done in partnership with other media. So, yes, the stories are appearing on our website at thefern.org, but they're also appearing on the websites of partners, which will have an order of magnitude, you know, much bigger audience. So, that's how we're getting the stories out there. But in terms of story generation, you know, our name is the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and I would say the emphasis is on network because we rely on a lot of independent journalists, freelance journalists, who are experts in these areas, and they're vetting story ideas with us. We're questioning them about them, and we're helping them develop their ideas to see if there is a real story there. So,
how do you keep the doors open? How are you getting compensation?
We're supported by foundations and also individuals, and about half of our funding is from individuals and half is from foundations. So, you know, we're constantly writing grant proposals, that kind of thing. We're constantly soliciting donations from our readers. So far it's all of the above has worked, you know, in order to allow us to do this work because people think it's valuable. So,
if it appears in a magazine or a trade association, do they pay for the stories, or do they contribute to the cost of doing the stories? Because
they contribute to the cost of doing the story.
Okay.
So, Yeah, I mean, we're in effect subsidizing the publication of the story because we're covering some of the costs, but in most cases, if not, I want to say all, almost all, you know, we're getting paid as well to defray some of our costs of producing the stories.
So, Sam, you're the editor-in-chief. Do you write stories, too?
I'd like to write more. I might be writing more in this year, hopefully. But, you know, so much of my time is spent developing relationships with writers and with partner outlets and, you know, everything else that comes from managing an organization that I don't have as much time to write as I'd like to.
So I assume
that that's my background.
Yeah. Typically, if you were able to just do more writing, as you're set up, a laptop or a recorder or a telephone or something, is that the tools of the trade, and you start building files in these areas that you're either working on a current story or that you'll use in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we're always scanning news articles. We're always, you know, looking. We all get, you know, feeds of latest science from journal articles. We're just constantly scanning stuff, and if, you know, there's an area of particular interest, we start to build up kind of, you know, a database of knowledge in it, and then pursue it. And, you know, and that's what all of our reporters who are working with us, that's what they're doing in their particular areas as well. So,
They're producing something that's in print that can be posted, I suppose, as a blog, an article. Are they also doing any video or photography, too?
Yeah, we have a director of photography who's teaches at Iowa State, actually, teaches photojournalism, and he contracts with photographers to shoot our stories, and we've gotten like some pretty major photographers to shoot for us, which is great. And you know, it really helps the story if you can actually see it, you know, and see it in a compelling way. Yeah. So we really like that, and we're doing more and more audio work as well, with various, you know, either local NPR stations or with national NPR.
Well, I think you've got a podcast you can post now, too.
Right, that's right.
Farm to Table Talk. Well, Sam, it's great to visit with you and what you're doing at Food Environment Reporting Network. And one of the things I'm taking away from this, though, too, is the journey for journalists that thought they were hitting a wall and that, you know, that you formed this organization and, you know, it's people that went to school to study journalism or thought they wanted a career in public relations or some other kind of communications and see a tricky way ahead. I mean, it's inspiring to see that your group came together and is providing a service and finding a way to, you know, contribute and participate in a career that you wanted to pursue, even though it wasn't perhaps the way people thought it would be 10, 15 years ago. I mean, there's an awful lot that we're able to wring our hands about, but what makes you feel good about what you see coming down the pike in these next several years?
Well, you know, I guess a couple of things. One, I started my journalism career in the late 80s, so I've been in the game a long time, and Fern is like my third act. You know, I worked in news for a long time at Reuters as a correspondent and editor. I was a freelancer for around 15 years. I wrote two books, you know, and then I helped start Fern, and it really took off. So as a journalist, I think since that period, despite the implosion, I think there's more creativity going on right now in journalism than I've seen probably in my whole career. So it's a really exciting moment, despite the fact that it's really economically tough for a lot of us to make a living, a lot of freelancers especially. So in terms of journalism, though, I think, I'm quite hopeful, and especially our model, which is, frankly, we're doing public interest journalism. You know, this is never going to be an advertiser-supported model. It really depends on the public, you know, and charitable contributions to keep going. And I think if people want this kind of work and this kind of knowledge, they should recognize that it's in the public good and support it. And they are doing that. So I think that's gratifying. And I think frankly, that's going to, in the media landscape, that's going to grow. In terms of optimistic in the next few years, I mean, there's a lot to be pessimistic about, especially in our political climate and the divisiveness and, you know, that it's become, at the very least, is leading a lot of people to hear the other side as much as they don't want to, you know, maybe to question things, and hopefully we get to a better point. I don't know that we will politically. That, you know, certainly affects the world of, you know, food, ag, and the environment. So, you know, I don't know how that'll end up, but it's certainly making for a rich area to write about.
Well, it's a rich area to talk about, and I want to thank you for talking about it today on Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you, and thank you for your interest.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.